This week on COINTELPRO, we dive into the world of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, maximalism, and human rights.
We've talked a lot about cryptocurrency on the show, actually. Our first episode had Bennett Tomlin on as a guest. Then last fall, we broke news on the show as a result of our series investigating Joel Greenberg and the Seminole County Tax Collector's Office in Florida.
Bennett and Mike ultimately wrote about our findings in that series for Protoss, a media outlet focused on cryptocurrency.
Right. And we should mention also that at @gal_suburban helped us a lot with the reporting on that. You should give her a follow on Twitter just to keep your finger on the pulse of the liberals who do a really good job of covering and thinking about Capitol Hill and American politics. But anyway, we also had Jacob Silverman on as a guest earlier this year. He writes for the New Republic and has written in many places, and he's a great follow on Twitter as well.
We should also mention that he is currently writing a book about cryptocurrency with Ben McKenzie.
That's a good point.
Who is a major actor in Hollywood.
And also a good follow on Twitter. Exactly. You can also follow us on Twitter at COINTELPRO Media and at TMS Keeper. And then I believe you're at Skipping Saucer.
Skipping Saucer.
And also, I don't think we've ever plugged it this early on the show, but you can support COINTELPRO Media on Patreon. I wonder what would happen if we mentioned Patreon for the first time at the front of the show. But we have one of those, and if you'd like to support us, it's there.
So a few weeks ago, Mike here published his second piece for Protoss, and we wanted to discuss that research on the show here today.
A little background about me. I have written about and studied human rights history, right? And to clarify sort of what that means, you know, human rights is actually like a body of law, of international law, treaties and covenants and these types of things. Declarations even of rights. And so this is something I've kind of studied the historical process of, and it's something that really only goes back to the end of the Second World War. But when I found out that there was a vector of the human rights topic that connected to cryptocurrency, I was really excited. And I was especially excited when I discovered like the human rights NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that promote human rights and human rights organizing and activism, that there are a group of these and of a group of human rights activists as well who see cryptocurrency as like the way, you know, as the way to solve what they perceive to be, you know, the biggest human rights issues in the world. And we'll talk a little bit about what they perceive those issues to be. But, you know, this concept was really exciting to me. And I knew that I had to pitch this story once I realized that, you know, this type of activism existed. And it was an opportunity to actually use my degree, which, you know, research-wise, doesn't happen a whole lot for a historian.
Right. So let's start with the basics. Can you tell us a little bit about the Human Rights Foundation?
The Human Rights Foundation, to somebody who is an outsider, you would assume maybe that that's an organization that's like very established, right? But it's existed for about 17 years, you know, since about 2005. It started with sort of the blessing of Elie Wiesel. You know, Elie Wiesel, who wrote a book that a lot of high schoolers tend to read in English class about the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel lived through it as a young person. But in 2005, Wiesel was maybe most significant at that moment for his support of the Iraq War. and the way that he had sort of lent the credo of his book and his activism to legitimize that conflict. So this is maybe worth keeping in mind that when Thor Halvorsen and the blessing of Elie Wiesel found the Human Rights Foundation in 2005, this is sort of in the ferment, the time period we're talking about. And as you might expect, given that, the Human Rights Foundation has a decidedly like rightward lean to it.
Okay, so hold on one second. A rightward lean towards human rights activism.
Let me see if I can kind of like unfold this a little bit for you. Like what I mean when I'm talking about a rightward lean to human rights politics and human rights activism. The UDHR, right? The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is sort of the main like document that is sort of chartering in what we think of now as like the human rights regime. Okay. And when I say regime, I'm just talking about sort of like an international norm and a standard. When we talk about, you know, human rights now, we're talking about sort of the treaty body and non-governmental organizations and international institutions that sort of make up and promote this notion of human rights as though it were law. Universal Declaration is created in 1948, gradually becomes ratified, and it's adjacent to the post-war efforts to establish, you know, a lot of the international institutions that are associated with globalism. You know, we can think of the Bretton Woods system, IMF, et cetera, et cetera. And it's sort of in that universe of ideology of the post-war era. And sitting at the table, negotiating the realities of the post-war order, it's obviously the West, okay, and capital. But we also have the Soviets and the burgeoning, non-aligned post-colonial world sitting at the table. And what happens with the UDHR is that it becomes simultaneously a document that declares property and political rights and civil rights and all of these things that are, you know, widely accepted in the West, you know, as the basic, you know, rights of the Enlightenment, essentially. But, you know, the left is at the table and the post-colonial states are at the table. And they also push for, not just in the UDHR, but going on in the treaty body, other types of rights, economic rights, social rights, cultural rights. And as you can imagine, you know, these are the parts of this universal international agreement that capital and the West and the right weren't big fans of. And so what you have from almost the very, very beginning is kind of a split in these things and a difference of opinion amongst sort of the national and capital holding interest about what human rights are. Human rights before 1970 are largely irrelevant. I mean, it's to like lived reality on the ground. It's not really until the 1970s that non-governmental organizations begin to pick up the rhetoric of human rights as a means for kind of advancing their causes. The construction of human rights in these differing ideologies of it was sculpted by Western non-governmental organizations and capital to emphasize civil and political rights over and at times at the expense of economic, social, cultural rights. What this means is that as human rights is picking up momentum in the 1970s, as it's becoming something that's being used in the language of American politics, of American media, the ideology of capital, you know, is really for the first time picking up this language. They're picking up the language of human rights with human rights meeting a very specific criteria, and that criteria being sort of the exclusion of economic, social, and cultural rights. So this hierarchy exists. You know, whenever you see a human rights organization that's tending to, you know, do anything, essentially, to be of any significance at all, usually it is off of the promotion of civil political rights and not often those parts of the UDHR and its ensuing covenants, you know, that would emphasize the other type of rights, the rights that that capital and the political right are less interested in supporting. We're talking about, you know, people who sort of very conspicuously see that most of the problems in the world are related to free speech and being able to move your money wherever you want it to move. Okay. That yeah. ends up being, you know, those are the two most salient values of the human rights regime in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to see the human rights regime, you know, so we're talking about the law, the courts, the NGOs, if you want to see them move in real time, threaten those two things, right? And that's, you know, you'll see an effective human rights regime.
So kind of in summary here, what you're saying is the Human Rights Foundation is one of these rightward kind of leaning groups.
Like of note, Peter Thiel has funded HRF, right? The Human Rights Foundation, you know,
which is very interesting because we've sort of discussed him a little bit, you know, kind of off the show in terms of his newfound interest in another topic that we cover a lot on the show, that being unexplained aerial phenomena.
Right.
When he's mentioned that quite a bit, those have been his two major topics he's been discussing at political fundraising, mm-hmm. dinners, meetings, and that sort of thing. He's been almost strictly talking about getting these candidates that he's bankrolling to focus in on cryptocurrency and UFOs, basically.
Right. Well, and, you know, Thiel's one of these people that, you know, tends to make the liberals set yeah. their hair on fire.
I think people who aren't really aware of Peter Thiel should understand, like, this is a guy, you know, he's a German-American billionaire who was a co-founder of PayPal alongside mm-hmm. Elon Musk.
Has a tendency to sue journalists. In fact, yes. one time, the Human Rights Foundation head, Thor Halvorsen Jr., was asked while HRF was hosting its annual like free speech conference, was asked about Thiel's tendency to sue journalists at HRF's free speech conference. And Thor Halvorsen Jr., the head of HRF, said that, well, no, that's free speech. And that Thiel should be allowed to do things to journalists that have a chilling effect on free speech, because that is actually the speech that yeah. best exemplifies everything we're going to be talking about today in terms of like the Human Rights Foundation's definition of human rights and even just of free speech.
Right. Wouldn't that be nice to just have like fuck you money just laying around like that? Like, oh, this person's criticizing me, I'm just going to fucking sue them. So
yeah. And use my superior financial position to leverage them into acting the way I want them to.
Yep. That's great. Yeah, it's great for society. It's not corrosive at all. So
and the best part is it's also free speech.
Right.
So this is sort of my vignette on like, this is what the right looks like in human rights. This is what HRF looks like. You know, we should use that as context going forward. You know, I think the Halvorsen thing is particularly interesting because, you know, I've tried to bring out in my own research, you know, case studies, stories about, you know, people in situations of repression and places where human rights violations are occurring. And, you know, one of my characters in like my master's thesis was a guy called Frank Tarugi. And, you know, Tarugi is one of these sort of like new left immigrants to Chile during like the Allende administration. And he ends up, you know, executed by, you know, the Pinochet regime. And I was thinking a lot about that Tarugi story while I was working on Protoss, because this story about Halvorsen Jr., you know, has sort of like inverse echoes of the Tarugi story. So Halvorsen Jr. is the son, you know, like a third generation heir to like a significant amount of wealth that's been accumulated variously in Venezuela, over the last like 60 or 70 years. I believe his like great grandfather is, or at some point between him and his great grandfather, there's a connection to Norway, right? But most of the wealth of the Halvorsen family was acquired in Venezuela. Halvorsen's father, right? This is the father of the CEO of HRF, was actually like a relatively high up person and sort of like the social democrat, like center left party in Venezuela for the longest time, but was ultimately imprisoned on like trumped up charges because of things he was doing investigating like drug trafficking and money laundering, right? In fact, he was investigating a bank called Banco Latino, which is now known to have committed like the greatest like bank fraud in Venezuelan history, right? And that's what Halvorsen's father was negotiating or was investigating when he was arrested and imprisoned for some sort of connection to a series of car bombings that had been going on in Venezuela. They said that Halvorsen's father was like plotting to profit from these like series of car bombings or something. But anyway, he ends up in prison. This draws the attention of groups like Amnesty International and you know, other significant like human rights organizations. Halvorsen's father had been like a part of certain efforts to like organize against violence going on in Central America as a part of like the Dirty Wars and all this sort of stuff. Halvorsen has this experience. He ends up released from prison because of sort of the functioning of the human rights apparatus, you know, basically drawing attention to these abuses that were going on in Venezuela, that were going on to this high-ranking government official who had a lot of wealth. And they get him out of prison, and he goes on to have like this career, you know, working for different human rights organizations. Halvorsen Jr., right? So the son of this person that we've been describing here, he is in charge of Human Rights Foundation, and he's the one who I was talking about, you know, giving cover to Thiel for like suing journalists.
Okay, so there's a human rights ideology for right wingers. So what's this got to do with cryptocurrency?
As of their like most recent annual disclosure, HRF has cleared $1 million in grants for what they call the Bitcoin Development Fund. And this is where all of this links in with cryptocurrency. What I did for the story we published at Protoss, in addition to talking to the person running the Bitcoin Development Fund, I interviewed these grant recipients and I asked them about their projects. And, you know, a decent chunk of the piece is just sort of, you know, my presentation of how these grant recipients think about human rights and cryptocurrency, right? And the relationship they're in, essentially. You know, I talked to people like Fode Diop, who, you know, he signed this most recent letter that came out about a week ago to Congress defending cryptocurrency, encouraging, you know, responsible legislation, you know, on these types of currencies and securities and stable coins, etc. But Fode Diop is a good example of, you know, sort of one of the types of projects that HRF funds. And this one is geared towards education, right? That what Fode Diop does is he teaches people in sort of the Francophone parts of Africa about Bitcoin specifically and how it can be developed and made more user-friendly for a wider, you know, audience, for a wider group of consumers. And in Fode Diop's opinion, the role of Bitcoin will be to create jobs for like college educated people in Africa. You know, I tried to sort of get to the bottom of, you know, what that would look like. How many people? Is that like a job that exists for a long time, or is it just like some gig work?
it's probably very vague. I'm guessing you found very vague answers to that question that you have.
That's right. So that's like kind of one type of what HR, you know, type of project that HRF does. There's a few that are kind of similar. So Fode Diop is like a significant person in the landscape of Bitcoin. He presented at the big like Bitcoin conference. He signed this letter I was talking about. The other type of project that the Bitcoin Development Fund run by HRF tends to support are these hardware wallets. These are like air-gapped devices, which can be used either to like transport like cryptocurrency securely or to, you know, transact with it as well. So these types of devices, you know, the imagined use for it is, you know, obviously not just being able to have access to this currency in a way that is portable and relatively cheap and air-gapped, but it's also the, the imagined use of it in the context of real like human rights violence and repression is that it can be used to move funds out of a country or something like that, that you could put your life savings on one of these hardware wallets and go to Poland or escape to the West or something like that. You really sort of push for like the most dire application of this technology and of what the Bitcoin Development Fund is supporting. You know, it's that people in repressive contexts can move their wealth out of repressive regimes and contexts.
So kind of what I'm getting from a lot of this is that the main function of crypto from this human rights standpoint, in quotation marks, is just that it's a good tool for facilitating capital flight.
That's a question that I certainly posed to these folks, right? To the grant recipients. And then as I should mention, I also got to interview Alex Gladstein for this story. And, you know, I did pose this question, and I'm not sure I ever got like a super clear answer, but I think that we talk about how like authoritarianism, you know, typically like authoritarianism that is opposed by Western capital tends to suffer what we call brain drain, right? And brain drain is really just sort of like a pro-capitalist term for capital flight that, like, you know, when a state tries to deny wealthy people access to their funds, to freely move their funds and all of this sort of stuff, that they, you know, who are typically educated and in professional positions, but most importantly are holding capital, they tend to leave, right? This is something that happened in the Soviet Union, right? That, you know, people, you know, all the way back to 1917 were removing themselves and their wealth from the Soviet Union, if at all possible. This is, you know, just something that happens when you try to prevent wealthy people from moving their wealth and accessing their wealth. And so it is noticeable to me as well that it seems like what we're really describing is just an easier way to, you know, to do brain drain in Belarus, you know, or to do brain drain in, you know, Ukraine, or to put it another way, to do capital flight, as you just said, in these places. And, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily weep for, you know, the regime in Venezuela or the regime in Belarus, if people are removing their resources from those countries. But it certainly seems like a strange thing to identify as one of your most pressing human rights issues is that wealthy people are getting it too rough in Belarus.
So the headline to your piece at Protoss is a question that reads, is Bitcoin a Trojan horse that can tear down authoritarian rulers? So obviously, I'm going to ask you here, what does that mean?
You know, you talk to any journalist, they probably didn't write their own headline. but the reason that's the headline, you know, it's grabby. It is something that people could gravitate towards regardless of kind of their feelings on cryptocurrency, I think, or Bitcoin especially. But the Trojan horse thing, requires me to sort of further introduce Alex Gladstein. So Gladstein has been at HRF for actually like quite a long time. He was like an intern a couple years before like Bitcoin was even, before like the Genesis block was even mined. Alex Gladstein, who runs the Bitcoin Development Fund for HRF, has this theory. And the theory is that authoritarian rulers who are opposed to Western capitalist hegemony will, by necessity, gravitate towards things like cryptocurrency, you know, Bitcoin in particular, because it's a way to access capital separately from legacy financial systems in the West, right? That they're places where dollar and euro hegemony, you know, are of no help. What Bitcoin will do, in Gladstein's theory, is as these authoritarian rulers incorporate it out of necessity, it will provide a vehicle for the financial freedom of people who have wealth and capital to abscond with that wealth or continue to use that wealth for their own purposes, you know, transact freely, save in places that aren't going to be subject to hyperinflation and, you know, all of these economic and financial freedoms that are, you know, the right to property, right? These civil freedoms that are so central to this ideology of human rights. Gladstein says that this is like a Trojan horse, okay? Like in the Aeneid. The authoritarian invites Bitcoin in, but contained within Bitcoin are all of these freedoms, which will ultimately make authoritarian rule impossible and untenable. This is the Trojan horse. This is Alex Gladstein's theory of what Bitcoin is going to do for the world. There's a paradox that's kind of apparent if you look at what HRF purports to be doing here, which is they're saying, so crypto supports these freedoms, right? It does so like in a way that it's like a priori for these folks. Like crypto does all of these good things, but it actually can't quite do them yet. So we need to take a bunch of money from the Western donor class so that we can fund projects that will get crypto so that it can do these things. And you can see how there's kind of a feedback loop there, right? Where, you know, at its core, you have this assumption that crypto can do all these things. You have the admission that it can't quite do them yet, but it could. So we need to take more money, right? And we need to give this money to these causes instead of anything else you could use the Western donor class's money for. Cryptocurrency has this kind of like aspect to it a lot of times where it's like, you know, just keep putting more money into it and eventually it's going to do all of these things you want it to do. And it is striking that that logic is basically there for these human rights organizations.
How would you explaining to people like why the Human Rights Foundation may or may not be this sort of potentially corrosive thing on society with how it approaches cryptocurrency, which we already argue on this podcast is a sort of symptomatic corrosive thing indicative of greater decline and collapse, you know, a larger running theme on the show?
I think the centralization of currency that has occurred in the last like 200 or 300 years, you know, probably has something to do with the growth and development of like human society. I think seeing currency become unmoored from the state is likely, as you say, a symptom of the declining capacity of the state to sort of organize itself hegemonically over, you know, currency. So we're seeing a step backwards, you know, away from state-led fiat currencies and towards the more complicated currency of landscape of currency that we have seen in the past.
Like I don't think it's any coincidence at all that we've seen, you know, especially over the past couple of years, people with a hell of a lot of money, you know, shift a ton of their own capital into crypto. And now all of a sudden, the rulers of cryptocurrency, you know, are in a lot of cases the richest people in the world and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the whole argument that cryptocurrency is this freeing thing from state controlled fiat currency, you know, I think it's a farce. Like the window for the sort of like theoretical freedom that cryptocurrency advocates sort of argue for, like that window was open for about a second and then it was closed basically the second that the rulers of capital got their hands mm-hmm. on this, you know, this new form of digital currency and stuff like that. And so it's like they've seized control over it and it's not going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, one of the ways I tried to get at this when I was interviewing Alex Gladstein was to bring up the deflationary nature of Bitcoin. If you don't know, you know, Bitcoin is capped at like 21 million, about 19 million of which have already been mined. And there's some, you know, debate about when that cap will be met. But at some point it will be, at which point cryptocurrency or at which point Bitcoin becomes deflationary. Okay, this is one of the things that, you know, really makes the Austrian school of economics, you know, side of cryptocurrency and of Bitcoin and of like libertarianism really like vibe out with this new technology is because it is deflationary, right? And conceivably so is gold, conceivably so are good and secure currencies in this worldview. So to try to sort of get at the problems of this world that they're proposing, you know, I brought up this deflationary scheme within the protocol and asked Gladstein what happens to like debtors, people who owe money when this system reaches its point of deflation. And the reason I ask this is because, you know, if you are in debt, as a staggering chunk of people, at least in this society, are, then a little bit of inflation isn't all that bad, right? Because it means that the value of the money that you took out, right, which is holding at like a stable rate, that is decreasing relative to the value of the currency that you're, you know, being paid in a wage or what have you, right? Now, obviously, we're talking about here like, you know, the right amount of inflation, obviously, right? Like hyperinflation, really giant inflation isn't good for anybody in like the short term. But the reason it's important to consider in the context of deflation is that it means that you will never outstrip the value of your debt if the currency that you're being paid in and the currency that owns your debt is expressed and transacted in a deflationary currency, right? The reason that this is important is because people that are tied to their debts are serfs, right? Like that's a feature of feudalism. And so if like the modern state is declining, wealth is being expressed in like a deflationary currency, you have this huge underclass of debtors who are perpetually in that position, then you have created a neo-feudalism, right? I mean, we can argue like, you know, to the extent that already exists or to the extent that term is flawed, and we certainly have on this show, but an underclass of people tied to their debts and a untouchable and unimpeachable ruling class is a significant departure. It would at least count as an intensification that is significant on the scale of like historical economic development and social development.